Hello, I'm Dr. Pamela Brewer, and you are listening to Men's Monday here on Mind Talk, the show that provides you with relationship health and mental health information every day. On Men's Monday, we focus on all things for and about men. Today's conversation is a bit of a treat for me, and hopefully at least a tremendous treat for you as well. I'd like to introduce you to today's guest, Jerome Anthony Gordien. That name may not in and of itself ring a bell to you, so try taking a listen to this and see what you come up with.
Looking in, I don't want to be left on the outside.
As we have discovered today, folks, we are talking to the person known as Little Anthony. Little Anthony, it seems kind of odd to call you Little Anthony at this point in your life, but how about if I call you Anthony?
Well, that's good. No, nobody calls me Little Anthony, this Anthony. It's not about my stature, how big I am, because I'm actually around 5'8" and a half. I think when you get older, you're supposed to get shorter, right? I don't know what I am now, but I'm not considered actually little. That's just a tag, a name, and I can explain that later on how that happened.
Well, let's start with, first of all, I am just absolutely delighted to have you on the program today, and I'd like to start with your beginnings, where you were born. I think Brooklyn kind of rings a bell. Does it ring a bell for you?
What? It rings a bell? And I spent most of my life in Brooklyn, at least my young life. But actually, I was born, I was told by my mother, on 98th Street and Central Park West in New York City.
Okay.
But I only stayed there a minute, and I moved. It was during the war, I was told. My dad, Thomas, was he got a job in the Brooklyn Navy Yard, and he moved the family to Brooklyn. And I think I was about 2 years old or a year or something like that. And then I lived in Brooklyn for a very long time after.
And what part of Brooklyn, New York, did you live in?
Well, you know, if you're familiar, I know a lot of people are transplants, and wherever you go, you find somebody from Brooklyn. I lived on Fort Greene Projects, right next to Marcy Projects, where Jay-Z comes from, off Myrtle Avenue and Flatbush.
Okay.
Flatbush Avenue, the famous Flatbush Avenue.
Gotcha.
So...
Well, tell us a little bit about what life was like as you were growing up in the Fort Greene Projects. I don't know that folks today really know what that world was like for you.
Well, the funniest thing is I had a great support system. I had my aunts who lived in Harlem, my Aunt Bessie, Aunt Sarah, Aunt Shorty. That's my mom's sisters. And my mother, my father, my Aunt Naomi. It was like, you know, in fact, in those days, families usually lived in the same area.
Mm.
Today, the families are like nuclear. They're all over the place. Like,
right.
I got a son in Seattle. I got a daughter in New York City. I got another daughter in North Orlando, Florida. But in those days, everybody basically lived in the same block. And there's a whole story about that, how that became. And then now, as the modern times came, families kind of split up and were a bit different than it was in those days. So. It was pretty cool. It was, and then I didn't, you know, people ask, oh, you lived in the projects. Well, at that time, the projects were government-owned. They were not city-owned.
Okay.
So they didn't become the hood yet.
I got you.
And it was...
So it was pre-hood days.
Culturally mixed.
It was culturally, it was pre-hood days.
Yeah. It was culturally mixed. Because everybody that was in that project that was supplied by the United States government worked at in the Brooklyn Navy Yard in one capacity or another. So there were Italians, there were Jews, there were Irish, you name it, man. Everybody was all over the place. In fact, I found somebody sent me a picture of a picture of all the kids, took a big picture in Fort Greene, where I used to live, in 146 North Elliott Walk. And it was just amazing looking at all the different cultures, all the different people. But, you know, after the city took it over, then it predominantly became more Puerto Rican, that kind of thing.
You know, it's interesting that you make that point, because so many times when we hear the word projects, we automatically think African-American, Latino, period, end of story. So it's interesting to hear that when you were living in the projects, it was really, it sounds like, to accommodate the workplace so that folks were close to work.
Yeah, that's what it was. It was culturally diverse, and, you know, so everybody worked there. In fact, I can remember my friends. One of them was Bobby Fasano, Italian kid. He used to live upstairs, and little Tommy used to live under me. He was a Jewish kid. And then, let me see, I can't remember how old it was, so many of them. And so, you know, when you're not that age, you don't know.
Yeah.
You don't have anything, that any reference to say, hey, I'm not supposed to be here. You know, everybody
right.
that I knew were my friends. And we ate in each other's house and all that stuff. And then after the war, that entirely changed. And slowly,
yeah.
it became the hood. You know, so at that time, I was just about getting ready to, you know, I was in my teenage age, sort of like 14, 15 years old. And I was going to Boys High, one of the most prolific schools in the state, actually. And I was going there. And so then it began, you could see the change begin at that point.
Now, before you got to Boys High, and Boys High certainly was very well known, it's still in Brooklyn.
Yes.
What was music like for you? Was music a part of your life? How did you go from being mom and dad, little bundle of joy, to this amazing musician that so many people have grown up on and continue to enjoy? What were your musical beginnings?
Well, my mom said that when I was 3 years old, I had some back problems, and that they had me in the Cumberland Hospital there in Fort Greene for a bit.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a few days. And they were doing, you know, trying to find out what was wrong. But in the meantime, at 3 years old, the nurses told my mom, man, he's keeping all the other kids up at night because he keeps singing. And she said, well, what is he singing? Well, I think it's from Annie, Get Your Gun. And I couldn't say all the words, so I would say, lay that pistol down, lay that pistol down, over and over and over again. And she said, it'd be 2 a.m. And I'm standing up in my crib and shaking my heart out. And that's natural, because I came from nothing but music. They tell me my great grandfather was a great singer, and he was a deacon in the church, and he was a great singer. That's what I used to hear. And it comes down to my mom. My mom was a soprano singer. She sang with her sisters in New York City. Originally, my mom is from Savannah, Georgia.
Okay.
And she came up with her sisters, because that's another story. She was forced up, you know, because the farm that they lived on, somebody tricked them in, you know, how the situation can be for black folks down there. And they had nowhere to go, so they headed north, because she told me her mother died. And her mother made all the other girls, all the other daughters, promise to take care of her. So they came up in a steamship. I can't remember the name of the steamship, but they came up in a steamship, you know, maybe like second class.
Okay.
I didn't have a lot of money. And those days, I mean, travel by train was very, very expensive. So they moved lock, stock, and barrel, all the sisters, and each one of them sang. My Aunt Shorty, my Aunt Sarah, my Aunt Bessie really helped to raise me, and my mother, and my Aunt Hilda, my godmother Hilda, put together a singing group, and they called themselves the Nazareth Baptist Singers, gospel singers. And then my dad was a musician, professional musician, who played for a minute with Buddy Johnson's orchestra, the famous Buddy Johnson orchestra.
Oh, my.
And a few other orchestras around New York. So I was inundated with music from day one. That's all I heard. And my house was just, it was big bands, and my father had always 78 records, you know. And everybody remember those with the little bitty hole in the large record or something. But
I vaguely remember those.
They were like boxes of that stuff.
Absolutely.
They were everywhere. Albums everywhere, and always music playing, and so that had to affect me. And the fact that DNA wise, in my mother's side, was in a lot of singers. So as it were, God himself put it in me to be a singer. I always sung. As long as I can remember, I sang something somewhere. So, you know, it was just something I did. I didn't realize it in the it was going to become a career, a life career. No idea that was going to happen. I just sung for fun, you know.
Let me ask you a question. You talk about your mom's side of the family, and they were living fairly comfortably, as I understand it, in Savannah, and they were robbed of their land. So
yes,
that's a way to feel really angry and really hostile about the world in which you live. But I don't hear that your family sort of went that way in terms of their reaction, and I don't hear that they taught you that by any stretch. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah. That's a fair statement. No, I wasn't there, so it doesn't affect me. It's just a story. It's history. Everyone has a story. You
right.
have a story.
Right.
Every one of us has some sort of story.
That's true.
I just happen to be a celebrity, and so it's more interesting maybe to people to read my story. But we all have stories, and they're not unique. There was a migration, a tremendous migration out of the South during the 30s and 40s. And a lot of people went to Chicago. A lot of blacks went up to Detroit. A lot of blacks went to New York City.
True.
And so on and on and on, Boston and everywhere. And so and that wasn't unique. But the fact that, yes, they were tricked, robbed of something out of this land. They had a farm. And my mother said they had farms, and they had chickens and all that kind of stuff. And they seemed to be very happy at that time until this thing happened when my grandfather died. And when he died, I guess, I don't know what happened, but they lifted the land from them, and they had nowhere to go. And they were told by another relative, well, come up to New York City.
And that's what they did. That's what they did. You talked about your early years being very much involved with music, and just kind of that was almost your best friend, it sounds like. In fact, at one point in a book that's recently been released about you, Little Anthony, My Journey, My Destiny, you say that you made friends with your voice. What did you mean by that?
Well, you know, I had a great imagination. I still do. I mean, my mother used to say, I don't know. She used to tell my aunt, I don't know about that boy. It's strange. He'd be in the room, and it sounded like there's three or four people in there. I had my imaginary friends. I had my singing friends. The comfort, music. Here's another thing. And since you said that, now my brain is working. I'm thinking about it. It also was a way for me to connect with people that I normally probably wouldn't, because I was a homely looking kid. I mean, I wasn't the kind of kid that was, you know, popular, oh, how handsome he is, and all of that. No, I was pretty homely and very shy, and introvert. And so music, when I found what I would sing, people would listen, and I would become, you know, a point of interest. And that kind of turned me on, you know. So music is just, it's a partner. It's a gift. It's not something that I created. It is a gift from God. It is a special gift. Many people ask me, hey, man, you're like 74 years old, man, and you sound like you're 16, 17 years old when you sing. I said, let me tell you something. My singing is not natural. It's supernatural. Believe me, I don't even know I do the things I do with my voice. It reminds me with when Michael Jordan was playing for the championship against Indiana. And so many years ago, back in the 90s, early 90s, and they triple teed him. They literally covered him. And he went back. They had like 3 to 4 seconds to go. And he fell back off his back heel and threw the ball up. Ball goes in the hoop, you know, and he raises his head like, how'd I do that? It's the same with me. I it's no way I'm supposed to sing like this. In my younger life, I was a bit of a rascal, if you read that book. I mean, I was a street kid.
Yeah, actually, I want to talk to you a little bit about that. We're actually going to take a break now, but when we come back, I want to talk to you a little bit about that early life, because you were more than a little bit of a rascal.
Yes.
So that's where we'll go when we come back from the break. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk. clearly having a lively conversation with the person that you may recognize as Little Anthony, Jerome Anthony Gourdine. We'll be right back.
Remember you, 'twas not so long ago, you broke my heart in two, tears on my pillow, pain in my heart caused by hand of fate, tears on my pillow, pain in my heart.
Anthony, you were very young as you hit the stage and became really quite the success. How would you say that impacted on your sense of self, your growing up?
Well, you know, actually, you know, when you're a kid and you're coming up, and then you're coming up in a situation where, you know, all of a sudden your environment changes, and then all of a sudden there's gangs. And in order to have some sense of belonging, you wanted to be like the guys, so you join the gang, and you find out this gang doesn't like that gang, and on and on and on. It's like today, man. Drive-by shootings haven't changed much because we didn't have any cars then. Nobody could afford one to even drive by. But people did some tough things. It was tough.
Well, let me ask you this.
I had to learn to live in that environment. But my, like, again, I had that support system. My mom and my dad, I had family. And they constantly, everyone constantly was on my case. And you understand, somebody once said, it takes a village to raise a child.
Yes.
Well, even in those days, our neighbors, man, it was neighbors, man, real neighbors mm-hmm. that looked out for each other.
Mm-hmm.
And they, if I did something and I was caught doing it, they said, I'm going to tell your mother. And then they would take me by the hand and bring me back to my mom. Or they even had the authority to pop me. You know what I'm saying? It was like, then I go home and get popped. You know? It's something else. So I think all of that, all those situations helped me to get through this minefield called life at that time. And I never felt sorry for myself. No. Because my people always instilled in me that there was somebody. There was something special. Aunt Bessie especially put that in me. That's why it's so important to be raised in families. I have a great respect for single parents and having to raise their children. And believe me, that ain't easy. But when you have the nucleus of the family that's together, that is a reflection of what society is going to be. If the family breaks down, then society is going to break down. So I had a lot of people around me that gave me enough information to get me through. A lot of my friends didn't make it. A lot of them did.
Yeah.
Got shot, got killed, something, you know, drugged out, whatever it may be. And then here I am. And that's because of the family and because I'm a faith person. Mm-hmm. I came up in the church. I don't know too many black singers that didn't come up in the church. You know what I mean?
Indeed.
I talked to Lisa Franklin about that. We were laughing about that once. So we go in the dark and we get out of church and it's dark. You know, so so these things were very important for all of us. That gave us something we needed. And so I don't ever feel, oh, poor me. Look what I went through, you know?
Yeah.
No. I mean, we didn't have a whole lot of money, but I didn't know we didn't have any money.
Yeah.
I didn't know. You know, we would go on boat rides. I thought that was the greatest thing in the world. My aunts would take me on a day trip up the Hudson River all the way up to Poughkeepsie or Bear Mountain, and then come back.
It's beautiful.
When we went, they had food. Oh, my goodness. My aunts put together all that food, and I loved it, man. I mean, we wouldn't do anything without food. We go to the baseball game. We have chicken. We have potato salad. It was wonderful.
It sounds like a party.
No.
Yeah. It sounds like a real party. Let me ask you a couple of questions. There was one point, you know, there's this concept that the kids who wind up in gangs are kids who come from dysfunctional households, single-parent families, and there's just nothing to go home to, and that's why they wind up in a gang. But you came from a loving family, an intact family, and you were in a gang for a minute or two. What wisdom can you share about why you, as a child, made that choice?
Well, you got to say that's another era.
Mm-hmm.
There was no cell phones. There was no internet. There wasn't nothing but where you were. And so it's a different era.
Uh-huh.
It was almost expected that you would, you know, get into the gang.
I see.
Today, it's a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
They really literally get in the gang to have a family because they don't have a family. I got in the gang because that's what you did.
Okay.
I mean, in your neighborhood, it was always that kind of a thing going on. My brother, Sonny, my oldest brother, started this gang called the Royals. Then they became the Chaplains. And then my brother Elliot was in the gang. My brother Donald was in the gang. And they grew up in this athlete of the gangs. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And then here I am in the neighborhood expected to do the same thing. And then also, remember, even though I had that big support system, I still had to go out in the world.
That's
I still
true.
Had to become have friends.
That's true.
And everybody that I had was a friend was in some sort of a gang. So it was almost expected. So, like I said, it's a different environment. When, you know, like even then, we didn't. There was a thing we used to call a fair one. When the gangs would come, I mean, actually fight
mm-hmm.
with hands, bottle, anything. But there was never no killing, shooting.
Uh-huh.
That was a rare thing to happen.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Okay.
And it was very, very rare.
Not like today.
It was very, very rare. So it's I couldn't compare that to today. Today is different.
Yeah.
It's really, really different.
And scary.
It's almost I can't put my finger on it, and I don't want to act like I'm an expert.
Sure.
I am not. But what I see and observe is something bitter. Something is more bitter about what's going on
yeah.
today than it was when I was a kid.
Yeah, you're right.
I mean, it was almost like a social club when I was a kid.
That's what it sounds like.
And if you got into
yeah.
some kind of fight or battle, or it usually was fist, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Or some kid would, we used to go to shop in high school, and even elementary school was called shop. In other words, you got to learn to trade
right.
and learn how to make work with your hands and a lot of woodwork. Kids figured out how to make a gun. Literally, they called it zip guns.
Hmm.
And it was not hard at all. All you needed was a little pipe. You know, they had these little sawing pipes, and then you had a wooden, you would draw like a gun. You would draw just the figure of a gun. You'd cut out the thing. You put it in there, and you would wrap it with electrical tape until it's totally tight. And then they had a rubber band. The heart of anybody
amazing.
Out there might ever remember that. They had a rubber band you put on the back of this thing, and you know those cap pistols?
Sure.
You actually get the lever there where you cock back that thing with
uh-huh.
a rubber band and make it tight enough. If you put a .22 bullet in there, it'll shoot. Now, it may go all over the place. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
It may even backfire and kill you.
Mm-hmm.
You know? But that's what we did. Today, they're coming with AK-47s,
exactly.
man.
Exactly.
You know? I mean, this is some serious stuff here.
This is true.
It's like, I'm going to kill you 100 times over.
And they
that's
do.
That's hate.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, I don't think we had that in us. We had more of a territorial thing.
Okay.
It wasn't about drugs. We weren't selling drugs on the street. None of that stuff I remember. Were we drinking? Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Drinking wine and all that kind of stuff. It's totally a different situation.
It's a totally different world. Let me ask you this. When you had your first child, fast forward from that period of your life, you had a child, and you were a child. How old were you at the birth of your first child?
My first child, I was, how old was I? 19?
So you were a baby.
And my wife, yeah, Judy was out of the baby. We were children having children
mm-hmm.
in that while. Judy, my wife at that time, she was 18. And actually, I met her when we were both, I was 15 and she was 14.
Okay.
That's 1957, yeah. Well, we were earlier than that. That was about 56. I was 15, she was 14, right?
Okay.
And we all lived in the same neighborhood and stuff. And so we, consequently, everybody would go out with different girls in the neighborhood.
Uh-huh.
Now, if you ventured out of the neighborhood, you do that on your own. You know, you take your life in your own hand. Because a lot of times, there would be some girls I really dug, but they would live in, say, Red Hook Projects.
Okay. Couldn't go there.
Where Fort Hamilton is.
Okay,
yeah.
You couldn't go there.
Yeah. And so I shouldn't go there.
I see.
but I did.
Okay.
Me and a bunch of other people chasing after little girls, you know? And so, consequently, I almost got wiped out. Yeah, it's just... That's one of the things I try to do in the book is be as accurate as I could. Which was Arlene Krieger to help me with the book and wrote it. Actually, I was telling her my memoirs, and it took 7 months. If I were to put everything in that book, what happened to me in my lifetime, then it would be a novel.
Gotcha.
And that wouldn't work. So there's so much that's missing that I would like. I try to put what I thought was important so when people read it, they can relate to it, you know?
Well,
but I just was just like any other teenager, man. I started smoking cigarettes.
Okay.
And I started drinking wine. I just wanted to be with the boys. You know what I mean? I just wanted to be accepted outside of my parents and my aunts. But my parents and aunts were a great place to be, too. And it was safe. It was a safe haven for me. But again, you couldn't live in that project without having some sort of a security blanket, and that's being in the gang.
Okay. You talk about in the book that by the age of 20, you had 3 children.
Oh, yeah. Now, oh, baby. Well, you know.
Help me out.
Like what says in the Bible, go forth and be fruitful.
You
well,
were fruitful.
I took it literally.
Yeah, I hear that.
So, no, I was I can remember as a small boy, I liked women. I liked ladies. I really did. Even a small kid, I loved. Remember, I'm around all these women, right?
Mm-hmm.
All my aunts and all of them, and they're doting over me.
That's right.
Right?
What's not to like?
So I'm right. See, I'm already, everybody, my cousin B, she was beautiful, man. And she don't know me. So it was mostly women that were raising me. Even though I had brothers, they were much older than me, so I couldn't relate to them.
Okay.
But I related to all the ladies. And so that's where it was, and I was always curious, and I come to puberty, and I'm still curious, and then, you know, kids in those days, man, just like kids today, they find reading material that's not accepted, and all of a sudden, the Beatles starts popping, and then you figure out, oh, that's what you're supposed to do with girls. Oh, okay, you know, and I guess the little girls felt the same way, and so we would experiment, and then obviously, my first child was actually, you know what? I'm glad you said that. I just remembered. I was 18 years old when my first child was born.
Okay.
And that was a young lady named Mary McPherson.
Okay.
And my daughter, my oldest daughter, is Antoinette, out of that relationship. Now, let me try to explain it. I was already singing. I was already doing well. I was in the Apollo. And the girls, now it's not girls anymore. It's now women. You see?
Okay.
But I'm still a young man. But the women start showing up.
Okay.
And the women, obviously, may think, if I can hook up with this little young guy, I can make life better for myself.
That's right.
And some of the old performers were hipping me, no, don't do that. Oh, hey, watch that one.
Okay.
Hey, watch out for that.
Okay.
And this young lady came into my life, and she was a couple of years older than me, Mary McPherson, and she was beautiful. And then we had a relationship, and then she got pregnant. And I remembered... It got, you know, in those days, if a girl got pregnant, you weren't married to her, it was something else.
Right.
And I remember my father saying, hey, I read the Jet magazine. That some girl pregnant. And, oh, boy. Here we go.
That's how Dad found out, reading Jet magazine.
Dad found out, reading Jet magazine. So that was like, what? No, that's not supposed to be. You got to get married. You know what I'm saying? And in the meantime, I'm a celebrity. There are women everywhere. They're just everywhere.
Yeah.
And now this homely kid, this shy kid, can have any woman he wants. I remember as a kid, I was one of my friends. I mean, he was somebody I looked up to, and he was wild. That's Jackie Wilson.
Okay.
And I used to hang with Jackie Wilson a lot. And everybody knows about Jackie Wilson. And there were women around.
So there was nothing but women around you.
Yeah. And so I got to that point, and all of a sudden I find that I really do like women. And that's the problem, but I lost what it's supposed to be. The way my family raised me was not, they didn't raise me that way.
Right.
But I started, the street where I was in, the life that I was in was pulling me in that direction.
And the
and
life.
So now I'm, you know, and then and you know, like, I was very sheltered by my mom, very sheltered.
Okay.
As a young man. But all of a sudden, I'm loose. Wow.
And it sounds like the life that you were living as a celebrity is the life that other celebrities were living as well. So you were just really kind of fitting in. Okay.
I was just mimicking them.
Okay.
You know, I wanted to be cool too. You know, I mean, oh, shoot, he's got two women. I want two women too. You know? And that's how it was. Now, you know, my mother and father didn't care for this. This was rough on them.
I was about to ask you, how did mom and dad handle this?
Oh, I don't know, man. It was like my poor father, man, he was just a gentleman. He wasn't a man that was like a disciplinarian. My mother was a disciplinarian.
Mm-hmm.
My mother was on my case, you know? And she said, your dad said that there's some girl she read in the magazine that you got pregnant. It was all over New York. And that was, in those days, that was really not a good thing.
No.
You know, today it's almost like it's commonplace.
Well, it's almost expected nowadays.
Yeah, it's kind of weird. But then, that wasn't the way you do. What you do is you get married. That's right. What you do, and you have children. And so here I am saying, but why? When I can have all these women anytime I want them. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So they came. And then, here's the thing that really messed up. My family went crazy. This woman, Antoinette, in fact, I just talked to her the other day. I'm coming to New York. She wants to come to the show. But anyway, her mom, Mary, there was no relationship there now. There was nothing.
Okay.
It was just a sexual. I didn't feel like, wow, no, I'm not, she's dying. She's beautiful, but I don't have a feeling of connection.
So it was really kind of a one-night stand, it sounds like.
She felt that way.
Okay.
But I didn't.
Okay.
So Antoinette was born. You notice her name is Antoinette Anthony. Antoinette.
Gotcha.
And then finally my mother got to meet see the baby and my father. So they kind of were really cool about the baby. You know what I mean? So that kind of cooled down. And I said, okay, I'm okay. I turned right around and had another affair with my first wife, Judy. But we were kids together. Remember, she was 14, I was 15?
Right.
At the same time, within that year, she got pregnant.
You were busy.
And then that was April. Okay, April, May, June, when is August. Then 3 to 4 months later, a young lady by the name of Melba Sanchez, Puerto Rican, that I really, 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 really had feelings for, really liked her a lot. A lot of fun with her. To this day, we are dear friends. She's my dearest friend. We're just friends. We always said we couldn't get married because we'd probably kill each other. We both had this strong will, you know? But she ends up getting pregnant 4 months later.
Oh, my.
And now Judy finds out. Then Melba, you know, is really, really a woman raised with a fine family, which to this day I'm very close with. You know, all of it. A brother, a cousin, B&B, all them guys. I talk to them all the time. She was in a jam because her father was he was a merchant marine, a Puerto Rican guy.
Okay.
And you know, Puerto Ricans is family. You know what I mean? This is not cool. So I got myself in this kind of a jam, you know? And all these babies. In the meantime, my poor mother was under all this stress.
I'm sure.
But even that, they still loved me. Unconditionally, and they took my children under their wings. In other words, like my son Andre and my son Tony. And isn't the funny thing? My son Tony is my business manager.
Interesting. Interesting.
They used to call my mother Mama because they were around her so much, they thought that was their mother.
Interesting. Tony, we're going to take a break. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will continue. And I'd like to fast forward to more of what's going on in your life today. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk, having a conversation with Anthony Gourdin. You know him as Little Anthony, Little Anthony and the Imperials. We'll be right back.
Yes, I think I'm going out of my head over you. So badly, I can't think of anything but you.
You know, I can see the young women and the little girls falling all over themselves after they hear you sing and see you singing that song.
You know, when I'm just listening to it, and I'm saying to myself, my gosh, how blessed that I am to have worked with Teddy Randazzo, wrote all those songs, and with the great Don Costa, who is Sinatra's arranger and a producer in many cases. I was very blessed, God. I'm just listening to stuff. And then I'll have people come around. Some disc jockey, some call. Or somebody will come up to me and say, oh, I just love the way you sing that doo-wop. And I look at them and I say, ma'am, I am not a doo-wop singer. I don't even know what a doo-wop is. You know, I'm a contemporary R&B singer. I wasn't put into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame with a special category for doo-wop.
Gotcha.
I was put in there as an R&B singer. I did not get, right now, I'm really looking forward to this, got inducted into the Rhythm and Blues Hall of Fame, and it's going to be held in Detroit.
Wonderful.
And I think the Whispers are going in, Aretha Franklin, myself, a bunch of people.
You're in excellent company.
So that's not doo-wop.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Let's talk about what you are doing in your life today. What's going on with Anthony Gourdin right now? I have the sense, as I was going through your book, that the young kid of 20 with the three children, the young kid who was doing a little bit of everything with a little bit of everybody, has mellowed out. You're a different person today.
Yes, and that's why I call the book My Journey, My Destiny. It's a book of redemption.
Yes.
Sometimes I've had people tell me it's a book of history. Some tell me they didn't even know that I was in the middle of civil rights, but it was so bad that I was totally humiliated and shot at. And a lot of people didn't know that. And so I put it in that book. But today, these are my best years ahead of me now. By the grace of God, I was saved out of a life that could have killed me. Killed a lot of my friends.
Exactly.
Frankie Lyman died over the OD. And I used to be with him. He was one of my best friends. That world that I lived in was self-destructive in many, many ways.
Indeed.
But most people don't know that. They see you on stage and they think you don't, you know, everything is wonderful. It's not. So many young performers today going crazy. Because they can't figure out who they are. Because everybody tells you how great you are. They define you. And they tell you, oh, you're this, you're that, you do this. And you're so good. But do you believe that? Do you understand who you are?
Exactly.
And what happened with me was, thank God for my parents, because my mother was a faith lady. My aunts were all, I used to go to church, man, like I said, in the dark, get out in the dark.
Mm-hmm.
And that God loved me, always loved me. He never left me. But I didn't know that.
Uh-huh.
So all those years of my younger life, there was this emptiness, and I couldn't find out what it was. So I tried to fill it with drugs. I tried to fill it with booze, alcohol, you name it. I wanted to fill it with women. I wanted to fill it with just anything that would make that little bit of loneliness go away. And what it really was something I love how Creflo Dollar says it. He says, we are spirit.
Mm.
You know, and we have a soul, and we live in a body. But that spirit is who we really are.
Mm.
And so my life did a turnaround because... And I did a movie, and a lot of people don't know I'm an actor. Yes, I'm a car-carrying actor. I've been in television everywhere. I'm a character actor, so many people didn't know it was me.
Okay.
And I did a movie called Contact 303.
Okay.
Back in 76 with Billy Dee Williams, Chad Everett, the late Henry Fonda.
Okay.
And on and on and on and on. Okay? The movie was never finished. It was about the Tuskegee Airmen. That was the first movie that was made by the Tuskegee Airmen, the Black Flyers that won more awards and shot down more planes than anybody during World War II. Well, they didn't release the movie, and I was being introduced you know, this could have changed my life. But now listen to this. Now that I look back, I thank God that they did that. Because all it would have done was reinforce that I'm this and I'm that.
Right.
And it don't let me get an award or something or win an Academy Award. Then now I have all the money in the world. I can get more drugs.
Right.
I can get higher. I get more women, the best women I can find.
That's right.
So when I look back in retrospect, this God that loves me just kept me. I shouldn't be here. There's no way. I mean, I used to hang in drug dens in Puerto Rico. You understand?
That's pretty dicey.
I used to, yeah, and in Harlem, man, that's going back alleys, man, to get drugs. And this was a bad place, man. And I knew it in my heart it was, but I just that's where I was. So in that respect, that my life was changed. And in 1958, in Redondo Beach, I was crying like a baby. I'm sorry, did I say 58, 78? I was crying like a baby. And at this time, I was married to a young lady who I've been married to now for 40 years. 40 years.
40 up. Years.
Yeah, that's Linda, my wife Linda. And she's my second wife, actually third. But that's a long story. That's in the book, too, how that happened. Yeah. But
okay, you know you're confusing people when you say she's my second wife, no, my third.
Well, okay. it's meaning that I married my first wife, Judy, twice.
Okay.
We got divorced, and then we remarried.
Okay.
That's
the simple story. Got it. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So I was so broken up that movie was not going to be released. I felt my life was over. This was an opportunity to be rediscovered, reinvented, as an actor as well as a singer. You know what I'm saying? And depression was so overwhelming.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And the last time I felt that kind of depression was in 19, and the book will talk about it, was 1970, where I had a nervous breakdown, literally.
And stayed
out of that. I came out of that, and then here I am again, going in that same depression. And I remembered I was in a little apartment in Redondo Beach in L.A., in Redondo Beach, California, and started crying and screaming and I started cussing out. Now, see, I recognized there was a God.
Mm-hmm.
I started cussing this God out that I had forgotten about. When I was a boy, we were very close. But I lost him. He didn't lose me. I lost him.
Gotcha.
And I'm crying and screaming and banging on the floor. And cussing everybody out. I tell you, my neighbors probably would have got somebody to come and get me and put me in the doggy bag and take me out of there because I was making a lot of noise. And then I fell to my face on the ground and cried profusely. And at that moment, that one moment in time, I can remember just like it was yesterday, I felt a warm embrace physically.
Hmm.
And all of a sudden, I stopped crying, and all of a sudden, I felt like the whole weight of the world just came off my shoulders. Now, I'm not talking about religion here. I'm talking about relationship.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know about religion. It's relationship. Is this God that loves me and loves all of us. He touched me. Now, I can't speak for everybody else.
I got you.
But he touched me, and changed my whole life. I never was the same again to this day. It made everything make sense. I realized who I am. I was blessed. My family was healed. My children came back to my first daughter, Antoinette, had seen prison, I don't know how many times. I visited in prison once. And I mean, it was that bad. Now she's a counselor for drug-related people in New York City.
That's
Isn't
wonderful.
That amazing?
Yeah, that's wonderful.
My other son, Andre, was this. He was just angry at me because of what happened, me divorcing his mother. And that anger is over. That war is over. Now, all these things came about not naturally. It's supernatural. All of my children. I got, 9 children. And I lost one in 2003, Casey.
Let me ask you a question about the loss of your son, Casey. There are so many times when couples lose children and they're not able to sustain the loss and continue on as a couple. What would you say allowed you and your wife to continue on as a couple, even in the face of such a devastating loss?
Our faith.
Okay.
As simple as that. I don't have any other way to say it. The grief is beyond anything.
Yes.
No one, anybody doesn't know grief until if they lose their child. I'm supposed to go first. My child should be burying me. I shouldn't be burying my child. You know?
Indeed.
All of those things that my aunts, Aunt Bessie and Aunt Sarah and Aunt Shorty and my mother and my dad, all those things they put in us, now is showing up. It's amazing I was just talking to my niece with my brother's daughter. My oldest brother was Sonny. He called him Sonny. His name was Harold. But we call him Sonny. The reason I do not know.
Okay.
But he died of a heart attack at a very young age, 57. Excuse me, in 1987. And his daughter, he had two daughters, Suzanne and Donna. He lost his son, Michael.
Oh, my.
And I was there with him and my other brothers, Elliot and Sonny, Donald. And we had to go to the morgue to see this. But you understand what I'm saying?
Yes.
It was the four brothers leaned on each other.
Mm-hmm.
You understand? And we were able to come through that rough time with him. So I know what it is. I lost all of my immediate family with a 10-year period.
Yeah.
I was living in California, and it looked like I was going to a funeral every other month.
Yeah, you talked about that in the book. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I remember that old gospel song, the hearse wheels keep rolling.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm grieving. My brother goes in 1981, Elliot. Then my other brother dies in 1982, Donald. Then my father dies in 1983. Wow, back on the plane. Then my brother dies in 1987.
Oh, my.
And then my mother dies in 1990, and my aunts all die. Oh. I'm on a plane going back and forth, grieving.
Yes.
But I couldn't grieve. I had to be strong. I had to be strong for the family. I actually was watching myself becoming a patriarch in the family.
Interesting.
You know what I mean?
Which is wonderful. Let me ask you another question. You talked in the book about the tears that you shed. And I'm going back now a ways, when you arrived in Richmond, Virginia, at a time that you were a national star. Your music was played all across America, and yet in Richmond, Virginia, all they saw was the color of your skin.
Absolutely. And that caught me. Now, I'm not saying I didn't understand that I was black. I look in the mirror today and know I'm black. You know what I mean? But I lived in New York, and of course there's subtle, things, but it was subtle. It wasn't in your face. I mean, I could go into movies whenever I wanted.
Okay.
I could drink from a fountain wherever I wanted it, or eat at the counter of A&S's.
Okay. Abraham and Strauss in Brooklyn, New York.
Abraham and Strauss, right. I can do that. My mother took me to juniors. They didn't say you can't come in here. You understand? So I didn't have that. But my parents did. They were trying to explain to me, now, son, when you go down there, it's going to be entirely different. Now, they tried their best to reinforce me and let me know that these things are going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't know what it's like until you actually experience it.
Yeah, and how do you explain racism to a child? Or to anybody, really? How do you explain it in a way that it makes sense?
There's no way to explain it.
Exactly.
It doesn't make sense.
Exactly.
You see, that's evil. Pure evil. And to go, when I went down to Richmond, Virginia that night, I have the biggest one of the biggest records in the world, and here I am having to sleep in this little cheesy place, what we call on the other side of the tracks.
Okay.
Because we couldn't stay in the major hotel of any kind. We had to stay in the black side of town. And this place was really, I could see it now, that a light bulb was hanging over the bed. A bed, one little bulb.
Oh, my.
And they had a radio in the room that you had to put a quarter in.
Oh,
and
my.
And use anything for 30 minutes. And it's Christmas Eve.
Oh, no.
And the next thing I know, I look and it says, colored, white,
mm-hmm.
colored, white. I'm going, what? I remember going to the movies, and I was heading in the door, and the man says, oh, no. Colored people at the top. we'd have to go up to the balcony.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, why? It didn't make no sense. It was so nonsensical.
Right.
And I'm a kid out of Brooklyn, and I'm getting rebellious about this, you know? Tough.
I hear you.
I started acting silly, man. It could cost me my life.
Indeed.
It cost Emmett Till his life.
Indeed. Indeed.
And so, but I'm a city guy. I'm saying, oh, come on. You know? What is that all about? You know? But there I was, and laying in that bed at Christmas Eve in this seedy little dump, you know, and I began to weep.
Mm.
Because, you understand, I was with my family in Christmas.
Yeah.
My Aunt Bessie, my Aunt Shorty, my Aunt Sarah, Dad, Mom, brothers. Christmas was a time for family, man. I'm just sitting in a little seedy hotel, and I'm saying, wait a minute, this is all wrong. You know,
absolutely.
I'm supposed to be a star, and I'm being treated like this. And that was the first introduction, and if at all possible, it got worse. The deeper I got into the South, the worse it got. Now, I was on this tour. It was called The Biggest Show of Stars, 1958.
Uh-huh.
And I did about, seven of those tours. And I watched the South change. I watched it change. I watched after Martin Luther King, who I had the great pleasure of meeting, and the struggles and everything else. You go South today, it's not the South. Back then, no.
Yeah.
No way. You know, it's just not even near it. But the point is that I experienced all of that. And a lot of people don't know it. Especially my people. They don't know it.
Yeah.
I didn't go on, you know, I wasn't an activist. I just was a human person, a human being, man, that was told he was nothing. I mean, I had a situation where a cop, we were in West Virginia doing a concert, and Bo Diddley was on. And I was standing in the wings, and this big white cop was there.
Uh-huh.
And he had a big gun. I never saw a gun that big. I found out it was a Magnum.
Oh, my.
A Magnum, whatever one of those huge. And I said, he was standing there, and I looked at him and said, man, that's a big gun. And he took his hand and put it on the gun and said, yeah, that's to kill little niggas like you.
Oh, my gosh.
I mean, that's just one, that's nothing. Shot at a white group come up to us. We were playing softball, a bunch of us, people on that show. We just playing softball.
Uh-huh.
And they were up in a big old nasty truck, or the open panel trucks.
Yeah, uh-huh.
And there was about seven, eight of them that were guns. And they said, you show up tonight, we're going to kill you.
And
that's
did you?
I had a semi-automatic little gun.
Okay.
And every one of us was armed. When those guys came back to intimidate us, all of us took out our guns, man. And when we took our guns out, that truck turned around so fast.
Well, that's good.
Smoke was coming out the wheels, man. Dust was coming out. They were gone. Why? Because we knew we were equal now. There was an equalizer here. This is 1958, 59, 60. It was horrible.
I hear you.
I mean, it was like they shot at me in Alabama, me and a bunch of performers, because we were singing at a stage. You got to imagine. You can't imagine this. And on one side of the stage is white folks. On the other side is black. And I can't imagine that. Who
yeah.
do you sing to?
Yeah.
So I was so rebellious. I got so mad at this stupidity. I sang to the wall. I told the group, sing to the wall.
You are married 40 years to Linda.
Yeah, 40 years this August. Yeah.
And
how did I go wrong? How did that happen?
Well, you know, you are a black man, and Linda is a white woman.
She's white.
And
they said it wouldn't work.
That's what I'm about to say. And 40 years ago, they knew it wasn't going to work. So what?
Oh, yeah.
For those who are listening, what's your guidance? What's your wisdom about making relationships work?
I had to learn, too, man. I listened. I read books, you know. You know, there's no books on how to fail.
That's true. People just got to know how to do it.
Right. So there's plenty of information out there to learn from others what they did. And we had our struggles, both up and down, back and forth. Sometimes we wish we were not together. Sometimes I wish I was in the moon, and she was somewhere else. That went on. And a lot of people ask me, oh, you all must have went through a heck of a struggle. Not that I know of. I mean, we ran into situations, you know, subtle things.
Uh-huh.
But we were so concentrating on raising our children in our life and coming up together and trying to keep the pieces together. I tell you, every time we look up, we look at each other and we say, oh, my gosh. Then we realize that love that used to be physical and you're attracted and all that. The love that we have for each other now is far greater than that love.
Mm.
Because now I found out she's my life's companion. She's my friend. She had my back. She, when I got sick a couple of years ago, I got my appendix blew up for some reason. Ended up in the hospital bad. I was in really that serious condition. Almost, I was in the IU. And when I woke up out of the operation, she was standing next to my bed.
Mm.
And she never left the hospital. I was there 3 weeks. They gave her a bed to sleep in with me.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And she was there. She never left the hospital. She had to go get clothes from Kmart. Now, that is when you realize, oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
that's really love. And so she came and this Christmas, she came and said, you know, I got a surprise for you. And she gave me my Christmas present. It was a cruise, on a Disney cruise. And that's where we're going next week.
That's wonderful.
You know, she saved everything, saved their money, and bought their cruise. And that's very expensive. And she knows me. She knows I love Disney. I'm still, you know, I'm sorry. I go to Disneyland.
Okay.
I can't help
okay.
myself. You know, Mickey Mouse and all that kind of thing.
I won't tell anybody. It'll be our secret.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
So, right. So I had a little of that going for me. And plus, Linda comes from a really strong family background as well. Her mother and father, and her father passed away the same year my brother, Sonny, passed away from a heart attack. And so all the sisters, she's got numbered girls, Connie, Diane, Wanda, you know, Brenda's an identical twin. So that helps. That we both come out of a strong family thing. You know what I mean? So she's really family, and I learned watching her. You know what I'm saying? How do you explain that? It's very difficult to tell people, you know, how do you do that? But you know what? My mother once told me, or these kids, David, they don't know about marriage, because when we got married, it was forever.
That's true. You know? And that's not, nowadays, if it lasts more than a week, it's a big deal. Jerome,
well, yeah, you gotta make me feel good. No, I don't. You have to feel good, and I'll share you feeling good, and vice versa. You know, it's the wrong way of looking at a relationship. This is a commitment.
Yeah.
But out of that commitment comes children, and they have children. See how it works?
Mm-hmm.
And that's not happening today. The TV, the radio, all the things, the movies, all telling you just the opposite.
That's very,
you know,
true. Constantly.
Do your own thing, and if you don't feel it, get you another wife. You ain't never going to find any peace.
Right.
You have to make that commitment. I'm going to make this work. And what happens is when you're married as long as we have, now I don't imagine her not being there.
Gotcha. She's just a part of your skin in so many ways.
Just a part of me now. It's who I am. It's comforting to have somebody that knows you.
Yeah, absolutely.
I can be me. You know, it's pretty cool, you know. And so maybe that helps somebody, I don't know.
Thank you very much. Again, Jerome Anthony Gordine, known as Little Anthony, Little Anthony and the Imperials, so many of us have grown up on and lived on your music and loved your music and continue to do so. And I thank you for sharing not only your music with us today, but the person that you are and how you came to be the man you are today. Thank you so much.
Well, bless your heart. Thank you so much. I enjoyed the conversation.
I'm delighted. And folks, thank you for listening to this edition of Mind Talk. You can listen to this program and all Mind Talk programs on demand at mindtalk.org. That's mindtalk.org. The managing producer is Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. The assistant to the executive producer is Lede Battle. Again, for more information about Mind Talk, you can always go to mindtalk.org. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, that number is 301-654-5286. And always, always remember, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable. Take care.